at the end of the day, do you want to, you know, when we're hopefully in a new future, do you really want to say that you sat there and waited for it, or do you want to be one of the people that pushed the boulder? Because you can't push the boulder alone, but everybody can push the boulder. We can get it up to the top of the hill, to, you know, if we're going to descend into metaphor here.
Hey, everybody, it's me again. I know all the cool kids are skipping over this part, but for all you squares still hanging on, hoping against hope, I'll say something worthwhile. I just want to thank you guys for your download and your time. This podcast has been a really special project for me. It's been vital to me, I guess you could say spiritually, to be able to talk to people who I love and respect about the ways that they navigate around this world of Legos and sharp coffee table edges. Every time I go in to record an episode, it's incredibly uplifting and a profound experience, and I hope all of you listening feel a bit of that as well. If you like the work we're doing at least there's this, could you please subscribe, rate, share this podcast with a friend? The only way I can afford to spread all this good, juicy love right now is by making all of my listeners do it for me. And I'll keep paying you in what are hopefully some really cool conversations until I can afford to buy you all Teslas or some Elon Musk space robot or something. So this episode, I talked to a good friend of mine who I'll introduce to you guys in just a little bit. And I don't want to say exactly, well, you know what, it's in the title of this podcast, so unless somebody's blindfolded you, you pretty much know what we're talking about. We're talking about grassroots movements. Something we talk about at length in this episode is that we, as, I guess, men who look like us, cisgendered, straight, white dudes, basically, that kind of discomfort that we feel when we are participating in movements like this. Some of the things I've felt in the past when trying to get more involved in activist groups is this feeling like I don't belong, or I'm not really contributing anything of value. Kind of like, no, they got it. I don't bring anything to the table. But a really important thing that my guest reminded me of was that that's okay. That's an okay thing to feel, and it's okay if you don't feel like you're contributing much. Because the best thing that someone in our position can do is shut up and listen. And it's okay if you don't feel like you're contributing much, because right now the best thing you can do is shut up and listen. And as someone who's been interviewing for a while now, I try to practice listening all the time. But damn, it is just hard, right? Like, what I do is on such a small scale. And so I'm definitely walking away from this with a better perspective on what it is to be navigating the world with my particular identity and how I can make use of it to be a better ally to people who don't have that same set of stats on their character sheet. I hope you guys get some goodness that I got out of my guest's optimism for the future, and because this is all about listening, I hope that that's something you guys can do for me right now. What I'm trying to say is, shut up. The show is about to start. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to At Least There's This, a show about some of the small good things in the bag full of Fabergé eggs that is our life. Shit's fucked, as you all know. We are recording this in mid-Jan, so the shithole countries comment just happened. When you guys are listening to this, I don't know if you even remember that because of all the crazy shit that happens on the daily in Trump's America. But that's what we're dealing with right now. Obviously, David Duke is down with calling shithole countries, so is Tommy Lahren. But it sort of feels like everybody else in the world, like even the most repugnant of people, are like, no, 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 that's too far. You can't curse on TV, Mr. President. So other than that, there's a bunch of other terrible things going on, as you guys well know. But in a world where the president of the most powerful country is calling other countries shitholes, at least there's
grassroots movements.
Hey, guys, I am with a good friend, Nick Scardarossi. Did I get it right?
You got it right.
Boom!
Did I get it right?
No, you screwed up your own name.
No, I mean the thing when I said
it. Oh, you nailed it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, there was no doubt you ever would.
I was scared.
Yeah. I'm glad you're scared. I like to keep my guests on their toes.
Yeah. Yeah. I am petrified.
He's so... it smells of BO so bad in this room right now. It didn't when he came in.
I fuse.
Is it fuse the right Yeah, way? I think so. Defuse. I got him that scared.
Yeah, I have an odor.
Yeah. It's a fear odor.
Fear odor.
So we're going to talk about grassroots movements. But before we do, I think... Do you want to introduce yourself to the listeners real quick, who you are?
Yeah. My name is Nick Scodarossi. I'm a comedian, and I also host a podcast as well called We Rebel, where we interview a lot of people involved with grassroots movements. So it's something that excites me quite a bit. So that's, I guess, yeah.
That's it. That's awesome.
I love my mom and dad.
He does.
I don't know what else. Yeah, yeah. That's about it, I think.
Yeah. Sick. Okay. Well, this has been a great show, guys. And
we'll be right back.
Nick, are you an optimist, pessimist? What's your general outlook?
I'm an optimist.
Really?
100%.
100%?
100%, yeah.
Okay. I actually don't get many 100% optimists.
100%, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me how do you do that?
I think... We talked about this before we started recording, and I do want to qualify it that it is very I am a straight white man, so it is easy for me to say that I am 100% an optimist. So I do need to acknowledge that perspective. But I don't know. I just think I have a lot of faith in humans. I think humans are kind of amazing, and so that kind of keeps me going. I don't know. I think that there's always like another day. There's going to be another morning. We're going to wake up to the sun rising.
Yeah.
And I think that there's, you know, I have moments of doubt and pessimism, but I think for humans overall, I'm very optimistic.
Can you go into that a little bit more? Because I do agree that humans are amazing, and that informs my viewpoints in some other ways. But how to you are humans amazing?
I guess, I don't know, I think that human beings have had a history of, when their backs are pushed against the wall, of responding, I guess, in a way. And I've had a lot of a good friend of mine, we always talk about the idea of, like, the soul, or the idea of choice. Like, do human beings really have choice, or are we, like, part of a program? Which is insane to say, but, like, there are a lot of people that believe that. I truly believe in a human's ability to choose, and I think that there's always been, I think there's a reason that we always, even when the good guys lose, we always remember the good guys, you know? And I think that there's always human beings that choose the right way. There's, like, abolitionists. I have optimism because there were abolitionists, and there were people in the Underground Railroad. You know, like, in the moments of great darkness in World War II, there were people housing people, Jews in homes and risking their lives. I just think that against great odds, there are always human beings that will always put everything on the line, and that gives me optimism.
Oh, wow. That's okay. Yeah, I follow. Do you want to segue that into grassroots movements?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
It feels like it's a apt segue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's fairly common what grassroots movements are. It's common knowledge, but maybe just to get us moving along, do you want to kind of talk about what they are categorically?
I mean, from how I define them, and there's probably different definitions, and there's much people with much more expertise on this that will probably roll their eyes. But I think that a grassroots movement is either, it could either start with a campaign, like you saw with the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think it can start with a movement like Black Lives Matter. I think it's when there's a common shared goal or thought, and a lot of people come around it, and it comes from the ground up. And there are people that truly believe in something, and just get involved, and there's not necessarily a big establishment backing. It sometimes grows into that, but I think when there's a common cause of a belief and you gather enough people to really make a difference, like Black Lives Matter, then that becomes sort of a grassroots movement.
How did you start to get involved with?
With the podcast, we've interviewed a lot of really cool people that are putting themselves on the front lines of, you know, the quote-unquote resistance happening today. And I've always loved politics and you know, believe in politics. And I think with, like, the election of Trump, I wanted to get even more involved. Like, I had been involved, you know, peripherally in college. I had some friends that were part of a group called the Coalition for Tuition Equality, which was I went to the University of Michigan, and students, if you were undocumented and you lived in the state of Michigan, you still paid out-of-state tuition. And so I had some friends who ran this coalition, and they kind of forced the university's hand into letting in-state undocumented students pay in-state tuition fees, which is gigantic. And I think that that kind of spurred something. And like Barack Obama is a hero of mine, and I've seen him speak a number of times. I was at a second inauguration, and like I think he also is sort of like my guiding light in terms of optimism. I think that he is sort of the internal optimist. And I think those are the kinds of things that kind of spurred me forward. And then when we started the podcast, getting to interview amazing people every week rubs off. I mean, there it's very hard to like not do anything when you're interviewing people that are just like going at it 100% all the time.
Yeah, that sounds like it's so motivating.
Yeah, definitely. It's hugely motivating, and to talk to people like that is fantastic. I wouldn't have it any other way. Even when I'm super tired and like it's like, oh God, because we do it every week.
Yeah.
But you know, you talk to some of these people and they make what you are doing seem like nothing, because you know they're like, oh well, I was fighting for DACA, you know, and we interviewed Juan Escalante, who is a DACA activist. He's undocumented, and it's amazing. I mean, you hear that and it really puts in perspective like, what are my worries? You know, it's like I want to get on a stand-up show. He's out there putting his entire livelihood, his entire existence on the line.
Yeah,
that's inspiring.
Okay, that makes me curious about something, because comedy does not have to be, but I often find, and this might be something from maybe an older generation, the people in comedy have a tendency towards apathy. And maybe that's not true anymore, because how can you be in this day and age? Mm-hmm. But how, as a comedian, are you able to give so much to something that does not seem funny? It seems true and important, but it feels like it's not a particularly funny thing, grassroots movements.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I host a show, co-host a show with John Zucker called Arts and Crafts, and we bring an artist on stage and they make a piece about the show during the show, and then we usually auction it off, and we've raised money for Planned Parenthood, the Gulf Restoration Project. I think we're going to do a show for United We Dream pretty soon. So that's, I think, a way where they intersect. But at the same time, they don't necessarily. And I've never had a problem with that.
Yeah.
I think especially in Los Angeles, people are always like, if you are an actor or you're a stand-up, don't have any other interests. And if you have another interest, then do that. I think that's bullshit, frankly. I understand people having that opinion, but can I swear?
You can swear as much as you
want. Okay, great.
Do you want to just swear real quick?
Just fuck.
Shit.
Piss.
Oh, you won.
Great. <Yeah. laughs> I thought we were going back and forth. But yeah, so I love like those kinds of movements. I love politics. I don't necessarily think it needs to intersect with comedy. For it to be fulfilling, and for me, I think that I have room on my plate for both. I mean, maybe I'll be wrong one day and penniless, but I don't know.
we all very well might be wrong one day and penniless. To be lucky enough for that to be the worst thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I dream of that. I'm curious about how this has changed your life in the last year. Mm. Because, okay, so 2016... Donald Trump is elected.
Yeah.
Right? It's fucking. Ugh.
Uh huh. I was in Las Vegas. I was in Hillary Clinton campaign field office.
Wow.
When I watched the results come in.
That sounds heartbreaking.
It was awful.
That sounds so bad.
Well, Virginia came in red, and there was an Obama alum on. Because I canvassed for Obama on election day in 2012, and I wanted to do for Hillary in 2016. And there it came in red, and then an Obama alum on the team was like, Virginia always comes in red, then it goes blue, and then it went blue, and then Michigan and Wisconsin came in red, and that never happens. So I was like, oh shit. And then me and my friend drove back to Los Angeles and did not speak except for the Hamilton soundtrack. That was the only noise in the car.
Jesus.
Sorry, you were saying? I didn't mean to.
Woof. No, I just wanted to ask about how this has changed your life. Like, say Clinton had gotten elected. How is your life different because of Trump's election than it would have been otherwise?
I think I am much more, and this is a shame. I will say this. This is a shame because I think I am much more apt now to go to a march and to help out with the campaign earlier than election day.
Mm-hmm.
And because I always, you know, get your voice out, you know, put stuff on Facebook and get involved. But I think this has changed now for me. I've always loved, you know, reading the news and staying informed, but now it's just like hyper.
Yeah.
And you know, even for me, that someone that like loves to read all this stuff, it gets exhausting. But I think it's definitely made me more involved. And I guess I say that it's a shame because, and it's something we talk about too on our pod, is like this didn't start with Trump and it's not going to end with Trump. You know, Black Lives Matter was a group before Trump. Emily's List was a group before Trump, and they will be groups after Trump. And so it is a shame that it took his election to get me as involved as I'm becoming.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess I will say that I have become hyper aware of everything around me.
How do you keep from exhaustion apathy?
So one of the things that when we talk to a lot of these activists is they talk about mental health. And I just keep reminding myself, like I said at the beginning, it's like I'm a straight white guy. And it's like if there are people that have been fighting before and will be people fighting afterwards, I have no excuse. And I just don't want to – at the end of my life, I don't want to sit there and be like, is there stuff I could have done? Mm-hmm. Or did I not at least, 70, 80, 100% there? That's – I think what keeps it is exhausting. It's exhausting for everybody.
Yeah.
But I just think we can't normalize everything that's happening. It's as hard as that is, and so that keeps me kind of going.
Right.
I guess in a sense.
And does that give you hope?
Yeah. 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 I mean, as long as there are people, you know, this is very Star Wars, but as long as like the rebellion is alive, I have to be. You know, and I think that it's important to do that. There are so many people that are putting so much more on the line than I am that, you know, I have to keep going.
So how does that...
I have to be optimistic.
Yeah. How does that get you... Let's say you're having a shit day, right? Just mm-hmm. like a shit day in you. You fight with your girlfriend. A car cuts you off in traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Does coming home and thinking like, well... Jesus, there are people like fighting at the post Standing Rock. You know, there are still people fighting offshore oil drilling and like missing Native women. Does that change your perspective on the shit day that you just had?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I try to, you know, and I do get mad at very stupid things. And I have days where it's just like, why is nothing working? But yeah, I definitely think that will change your perspective and appreciation for things. And asking yourself, like, does it really matter? I don't know. I turned 27 and it's been a whole lot of like, does this really matter? Like, it really hit me like a brick wall.
Yeah.
There are certain things I'm like, why am I getting hysterical about this sort of stuff when I don't need to be?
Like, I'm turning 28 in a month,
uh-huh.
and it's a very similar, like, none of this is, why am I doing of this?
I've wondered a lot if, like, am I having, like, a pseudo-existential crisis because of the administration or because I'm in my late 20s? I don't know.
They've coincided pretty perfectly for people of our generation.
Yeah, I don't remember death being as much of a thought. Until Trump got elected, and now it's like all the time. You're like, oh, death is all around
us. It's near constant. I'll get in a fight with my girlfriend and be like, we could die tomorrow. Do I want our last words to be anger over who did the dishes wrong?
Yeah, I think about that all the time.
Yeah. Like,
I don't know. I don't know if that's a product of getting older or that's a product of Trump or it's a product of both and we're just getting this like shit smoothie.
Yeah, I think it's
but.
I for me, it's shit smoothie.
Yeah.
I think that, yes, we are, my body is aging. Mm-hmm. I've reached the first point in my life where I just hurt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
For no reason.
Yeah. Hangovers? Whoa.
I don't drink at all anymore.
Really?
I can't.
Yeah, I'm trying to like leave alcohol for a little bit to try, or like once a week, which, you know, wow.
You're a stand up. It's so hard to avoid.
It's so hard. It's hard too because I get nervous all the time. And so I like to have like a little bit of like just one drink just to like chill a bit. And now I don't really do that. I'm trying not to do that. But yeah, it's like a constant. You have like a couple of drinks and the next day it's just miserable.
I had a few drinks at my brother's wedding,
uh-huh.
and the next day I like couldn't get up.
Really?
Yeah.
It's either that or I don't get hungover at all, because like I've had a couple of nights where like I will eat a lot of food and then drink a lot and nothing will happen, and that I don't really remember that happening as much. Like like there are nights where I'm just like, why am I not drunk? What is going on? Like I wanted to be drunk. And now I'm full of food and drink, and I'm just sleepy.
It's because your body just wants you to be miserable.
Just wants me to be miserable.
Guess what, asshole? You are dying.
Yeah, yeah.
Dying.
I'm dying.
You should have had 12 kids by now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, at this point, yeah, I would have been a father like 3 or 4 times over.
So many times.
Back from the war.
Right, with many different people.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's yeah.
That is crazy. We are getting older and we are dying. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are falling apart.
Sure.
And also, our bodies are falling apart while it's.
And we're not old, too.
We're not
That's
old.
The thing. It's like people, I talk to people and they're just like, oh man, I remember when I was like 27. You're so young. And I'm like, really?
This is it?
You think of that as so young? It's kind of comforting. I've heard 30s. Yeah. I heard the 30s are amazing.
I hope. Yeah.
I'm just a ball of stress.
Me too. We're all very stressed, I think, as a generation. But it again, it's like, well, who gives a fuck that I'm stressed? I'm not on the front lines of like the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm not being that brave.
I had a friend of mine. He is part of, oh God, what are they called? It's called If Not Now.
Yeah, I know If Not Now. They're a Jewish movement. Right?
Yeah. So. But yeah, I saw a video of him. Linked arms with other Jewish people, and they were protecting a Palestinian town from the Israeli guard, and he just got the shit beaten out of him.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, and he was linked arms with a woman who was training to be a rabbi, and she got her arm broken. It was nuts. And so it's like, yeah, I'm stressed over, like, my comedy career.
Yeah.
But my friend's getting, like, the shit kicked out of him by the Israeli guard.
How?
So it's like...
Okay, how do you handle that cognitive dissonance? Because that's something that there's got to be a coping mechanism for. Because people always want to talk about the coping mechanism for, like, dealing with this 24-hour news cycle of, like, every day it's a different monumentous thing. We can't even think about Puerto Rico anymore because we're too stressed about North Korea, and then we're too stressed about oil drilling, you know. But how do you also handle the, like, I want to do things, but me, as a straight white guy,
mm-hmm.
I cannot be in the front.
Yeah, totally. I think one of the things that we as a demographic have been instructed to do, which I try to do, is listen more. And I think that your demographic sometimes defines your participation. And I think as a straight white male demographic, our participation within the resistance comes from listening a lot. So like when we do interviews, I try to listen a lot more than pipe up sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And I think that is a form of resistance just as much, because we are rebelling against the majority of what our group believes. You know, I mean, frankly, straight white men are a pretty bad group overall. We've not had a great existence.
No, it's we got to drive the car and we've just been putting in different
lanes. And we have
been,
not taking care of the vehicle. So, I think that listening and, you know, trying to understand a perspective, I'm not saying realize that perspective because it's impossible. But to understand a perspective that's different from your own is also a form of resistance to a certain degree. And then getting involved. I think, you know, with the Women's March, it's like, I think that men should be there. I think that, you know, you shouldn't be leading the march, but you should be there. There's a power in solidarity, which I think is important.
Yeah. What's the most important thing you think you've learned from listening?
I think hearing people's experience. Because there's a certain degree where it's like, oh, it's bad.
Right.
And then you hear someone's actual perspective or something that happened to them, and it changes things dramatically. You know, like, you get older, you get the more you get to talk to your parents and learn about them. Like, my mom is a foreigner, and, like, you know, I get to hear more about her perspective now, and it's insane, you know, the things that she has had to put up with. Or, you know, I have friends, you know, that are African American. You hear their stories, and it's like, that's been the big thing now. More, that's like, it's one thing to read an article in a newspaper, but to actually hear someone and be, you know, face to face with somebody who has experienced that kind of prejudice is kind of jaw dropping.
Does it change the way now that you navigate things?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I think, yeah, and I think that's a product also of growing older. But I think if you really put yourself in there and you try to understand, you know, what's at stake and what are the experiences, it definitely changes how you go about things and how you talk about things. And, you know, I mean, like, to give an example, and, like, you know, to honest street here, my girlfriend and I have been having, we've had a big discussion about girl versus woman.
Mm.
I used to say girl all the time, and she was like, woman. And I never meant it maliciously, but she was explaining, she was like, do you say boy? And I was like, no, not really.
Yeah.
You know, do you call people boy? And so I was like, no. And so she was like, well, then why girl? And so it's a thing where I will try to stop and correct myself as much as possible. But it's hearing their experience that I think is kind of, you know, you're just like, oh, my God.
Unlearning language is, so I am not, I am... Beginning of 2017, I was out on the street constantly, and then I have just really let that slip towards apathy.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to maybe, like, tried to join some movements and stuff, and just felt like, man, like, even as a person who's just here to listen, I feel really alienated, and that I know this isn't about me feeling comfortable, but I don't feel like I'm doing good work or helping anybody, so I just felt a little lost and stopped showing up. So that is my that's my caveat. And really, like, shame on me legitimately for that, for not showing up, especially because I care. But I am learning. I'm still learning actively and making some of the small social changes to make room for people. And one of those biggest things is language, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just, like, picking apart the words that we use in everyday speech and how those words can be harmful and painful in ways that you didn't think. Or just, like, alienating to other people.
Totally.
And that conversation is a great example of that. That's a word that, like, yeah, I would have never thought why do we say girl instead of woman or anything? But it's...
I think sometimes there's a certain aspect to, like, the rhythm of language. I think girl comes off easier if we're talking just, like, syllables.
Right, it's monosyllabic.
If you're going down to, like, the base root of language.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's how you approach it. I also think, to address what you're saying, I think, you know, we're supposed to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, and I agree. There are times where I'm like, oh, I don't feel welcome or I don't feel comfortable. But that's appropriate. You know, that's how we need to feel, frankly.
Yeah.
At the moment. And I've had that thought, too. It's like, oh, should I be here or should I be a part of these things? I feel uncomfortable kind of like being the face of the oppression. So it's just like, but at the same time, it's like, sit, listen. You are there to listen. And if you are uncomfortable, they have been uncomfortable. Everybody else has been uncomfortable since the dawn of time. Because of us.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Is that something you would say to somebody who's not, who hasn't tried yet? Like, just go, just be uncomfortable?
Yeah. 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 And I think it's important to, like, it's important to go, yeah, to put yourself in an uncomfortable situation. It is not easy to sit in the mirror and say, I have benefited from structural racism, or I have benefited from the fact that I'm a man. I mean, the Me Too movement, it's those things. It's tough to, like, you know, look back and be like, where are places that I have benefited? And that's difficult, but I think it's very important to do that. I'm not saying I'm the best at it. It's very hard, but I think that, you know, part of this
needs to
be... Oh,
shit, then you better leave. I'm only here for the best at it.
Oh, no.
If you're not the champion at looking at your own faults, you get the fuck out.
I apologize. I knew I wasn't qualified for
that. Get out. Does that give you hope, then, that people are doing that? That people are doing that work?
Yeah. Yes, and I think I really believe in reform, too. I think there is room for reform for a lot of things, and I think sometimes there is a separation on the left of there is too much. I think that there are some things that, you know, might be non-reformable. I don't know. But I think that there is space for reform, and there is space for apology, and there is space for learning. There are probably people that disagree with me, and I understand that. And again, my perspective is a skewed one. But I do believe that if we take responsibility and take a look back at ourselves, I think that it's important. It's important, too, to work from our mistakes. Yeah. You know, I think that, and I've talked with a lot of people recently about this, but I think that there's a really big problem with how we raise men in this country.
I agree completely, and I agree with that about how that's made my life what it is. But whenever I'm thinking about it, I'll start to get in this rhythm like, yeah, I was raised in this and that. And like, well, now am I just kind of victimizing myself about things that I have done
sure.
to hurt other people?
I think if you go down the hole of like, I was raised like this and this led me to this, and I think it is easy to, yeah, potentially victimize yourself. But I think there's also the sense if you say, I was raised like this, how can I apply this differently to my offspring if I have kids?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's where it could separate. And I think that that's important. I mean, there's things that, you know, I had to learn growing up, and I was lucky. I have a very compassionate father who listens to me, who was never afraid to be who's not afraid to be emotional in front of me. He's not a perfect man. I'm not a perfect man.
Yeah.
But I was lucky to have that, and so I hope that I can take what I've learned and that ability, and if I have sons one day, I can talk to them and say, you know, say woman, and it's okay to cry.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So I think that looking in the mirror and using it to carve a path forward is important.
Have you seen any positive changes? I think I have seen some,
yeah,
even already, but I'm curious if you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wish that more men, well, any men, frankly, had said anything at the Golden Globes. I was like, because there was an article that came out the next day, it was like, no men said anything. And I was like, you're right. Mm. Nobody really said anything. Yeah, I think that there are beautiful things coming forward. I mean, like, you look at, if we're talking electorally, you know, you look at Virginia,
yeah,
with the governorship, with the attorney general, the state house. That's amazing. Those are amazing things that are showing that, you know, there is a path forward. There is a way. We will respond to something. And I think that the reason we see all these movements taking center stage is gives me optimism for a path forward, because I think those are the loudest ones, and I think that this period of time is going to be truly defined by those movements, not by Donald Trump, who is a symptom of a disease, to be very clear.
Yeah.
But not by him. I think that this is going to be defined by the movements, and it's going to be defined by the resistance, and that, yeah, that's the positive change that I see moving.
Well, then where do you see it going? Because you're not be optimistic.
Bernie 2020,
okay.
Baby.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding.
There, I don't even. I was big on the Bernie train.
Oh, me too, for sure. Yeah,
for sure. But I don't know if I would even vote for him in 2020.
I don't think I would.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think maybe he made room now for other people that could be just as wonderful and maybe hit other things that are necessary right now.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you excited about in 2020?
Well,
I know that's so fucking
my pivot
far away.
Will say I'm more excited about 2018.
Boom. He did it. Ladies and gentlemen, round of applause. He did it.
That will be my pivot. I'm more excited about 2018. Cause I think we have a real shot at taking back the House. I think we have a slight shot at taking back the Senate. I think that's important. I hope we take back the Senate. And I hope that Ruth Bader Ginsburg just
hangs in there
going and Kennedy, frankly, cause you know, his ruling, wasn't it him that gave us gay marriage?
I'm pretty
everywhere?
Sure it was Kennedy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and they're, you know, 80. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 84, 85. I mean, I get people are living to like 1,000 these days, but,
yeah.
You know.
She's all just vim and vigor, just
knock
holding on,
on.
Yeah, vinegar.
Yeah.
So 2018, be optimistic as shit, right? Like, be Fantasyland optimistic. What do you see?
Fantasyland optimistic. Well, there are – so we're down 24 seats, I believe, in the House, and the most optimistic estimates put us at 72 seat switch, so around there. So let's say 80.
Damn.
Let's say my most optimistic would give Democrats almost a 60-seat majority in the House.
Wow.
And then in the Senate – you know, let's say we defend, my most optimistic is we defend all, there are more vulnerable Dems, but let's say we defend all of them. And then we steal both Arizona seats, and then we steal Nevada, and then we steal Texas, right?
Texas?
Yeah. I think Beto O'Rourke is a candidate. He's a House representative, but he's running, he's very Bobby Kennedy-esque.
He's running against Cruz, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really like him. There's a really cool profile of him in the Rolling Stone, which I highly recommend. So what would that give us? So that's like a four. So if we defended everyone, that's 49 seats. So 53 to 47. So that would give us a majority. And we would have a majority in the House and the Senate. So we could stop any Supreme Court, you know, shenanigans, God forbid.
Yeah.
That's, I think, my most optimistic. And honestly, I think that it's possible. I think that we could see a 40-seat switch and, you know, maybe 51 to 49. I think it's possible. Knock on wood, you know. I think my most optimistic is a little higher, but I don't think that we're, like, far below right now. I mean,
yeah.
He says stupid shit every day.
Every day. Like, constantly.
Constantly.
You know, the thing that's given me the most optimism recently is the spiral staircase like fall of Steve Bannon.
Oh God.
That more than anything has made me see that, like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe things can turn out all right. Because this person who is truly awful.
Yeah.
Is like, everyone's like, oh yeah, this guy does suck.
He's the worst. Someone once described him as he looks like if Nick Offerman drowned.
I've heard he looks like Philip Seymour Hoffman was dug up Steve Bannon.
Oh, no. Oh, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman. That's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking.
What were we saying?
We were talking about
Steve Bannon. Yeah, how much of a piece of shit he is.
A piece of shit he is. His fall and the potential for a 2018 sweep gives me true optimism.
Well, I think, too, politics is cyclical. It is. And, you know, you go from Bill Clinton, 8 years of Clinton, to 8 years of Bush, to 8 years of Obama, to hopefully 4 of Trump. But it's always Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat. And so I think we were going to be due for a switch when this sort of thing happens. I mean, Bush had great numbers for his midterm, or I'm sorry, for his reelection campaign, somewhat great because, I mean, 9/11 definitely boosted his approval rating to like 90%, and then it cascaded down. But it was still at a point where, you know, he held on. This is gonna. I mean, there. You know, we are due for a wave. That's the thing. Is even mathematically, you can be optimistic. Even if Trump was a run of the mill Republican in office, mathematically, you can be optimistic that Democrats will get off their ass because we lost. I love Obama, but we lost a ton of House and Senate seats under him. And that sucks. I'm not blaming him solely for that. But even statistically, you can be optimistic. Added on top of that, we have people invigorated in ways that I have never seen in my life.
Fear will do that to a person.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm very optimistic about that. And then I think once we get there, the real work happens. Because people think, oh, we're going to win and ride off into the sunset. And it's like, no. Because there are still Democrats that are farther right. And I think that we need to make the Joe Manchins and the Heidi Heitkamps, that needs to be the new right. I think that moderate Democrats need to be the new right, and we need to push and have a new left. And I think that, you know, that's when the work begins.
Do you see that work already happening now? And does that
does
that keep you from despair?
Yeah.
I keep going back to despair right now is that this is all very big and very, like, this is all like pulleys and machines working. And I want to know how you, as a member of this world, how does this keep you from turning on the news and saying, like, fuck it, I'm going to drive my car into the river?
I guess, I don't know, when Trump first got elected, one of my really good friends from back home, she's amazing, her name's Eleanor, she got kicked out of Cobo Hall in Detroit for protesting a Trump speech. She's part of a group called the Cobo 14. And she told me, and she does a lot more work than I do, and she told me that the next 4 years we're going to see some of the worst things we've ever seen, but we are also going to see some of the best. And so that's what keeps, I think, for me on a personal level. I mean, yeah, I think on a lot of things, you know, I want to run for office one day. It's like that sort of stuff. It's like I do think of things on sort of a macro scale. But I think also it's like it's politics starts at the ground floor. And so, you know, you look at people like Shaughnessy Naughton, who runs 314 Action, or Amanda Littman, who runs Run for Something. And 314 Action is encouraging scientists to run, and Amanda Littman is focusing on like school boards and state house seats, and she was very much, her hand was in the Virginia elections. I think that that's important, and I think that for me personally, as someone who, you know, maybe wants to get further into politics one day, mm-hmm. and who you know is peripherally involved, I guess, does that answer the question?
That does. If I can try to reiterate what you just said, it's that you start up your car and you're heading towards the river, and then you're like, wait, there's some people doing some really cool shit in the face of adversity.
Yeah.
Why don't I go to Jack in the Box instead?
Yeah. Or go and sign up, you know, find your local Black Lives Matter chapter. Sit down, you know, and listen.
What advice would you give to somebody who's listening to this right now and they're like, fuck, I should do a little more?
It is okay to be uncomfortable. It is not something that I guess I can say will go away, but I think that at the end of the day, do you want to, you know, when we're hopefully in a new future, do you really want to say that you sat there and waited for it, or do you want to be one of the people that pushed the boulder? Because you can't push the boulder alone, but everybody can push the boulder. We can get it up to the top of the hill, to, you know, if we're going to descend into metaphor here.
let's descend all the way.
Yeah. Be uncomfortable. Get uncomfortable. There are so many people that I talk to that are activists that make me so uncomfortable because I am not doing enough, and I am part of the group that is the oppression. And it is, you have to get uncomfortable. You have to. You know, and not in a sense that it's like I feel danger or anything like that, but it's uncomfortable because you're just like, oh my God, I benefited. Yeah, and I will say, it's like, I can get 100 times more involved than I'm getting. You know, it's like I host a podcast. so it's like, but it's still important to put yourself in any, I guess, in any sense that you can be uncomfortable. I think it's very ironic that they call liberals, you know, like we're in our bubble, because I don't think that there's anything more popping of a bubble than realizing, you know, being uncomfortable.
Oh, I'm in a bubble because I have to listen to all these people whose lives have been ruined by my very existence.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, why? Yeah, it's and that's hard, but we have to do it if we're going to move anywhere. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's very funny when they say the bubble. It's like, what bubble? there certainly are no bubbles here. I don't.
There are too many sharp edges for these bubbles.
Yeah, this is not a sudsy situation.
So. Is there anything we have not touched on that you think you just want to philosophize maybe, or you would love to get your thoughts out about this that I have not asked the right leading question?
No, I think this is great. You're a great interviewer.
Oh, well.
And you have a great radio voice, pod voice.
Stop looking at me like that.
I'm giving you a look. Oh. And the beard? I'm just a big fan.
Guys, I'm getting a little uncomfortable.
We did. What was the last time we saw each other? When remember that we moved that shelf out of the back of my car?
So Nick and I used to kind of work together. Mm-hmm. And then Nick is the example of that person who I really like and we never hang out.
Yeah, I would say that the same.
Yeah.
Back
at you. Last time we saw each other, did we just get coffee or something?
We went to that tea shop.
Oh, shit. We went to.
Or no. What was it?
Where did we go?
Where was it? You knew the guy. You talked to the guy about tea forever. There was clothing.
Oh, shit. Yes. We went to, like, this cool, weird, like, Japanese store called New High Mart.
Yeah.
Like, on Vermont. Now we're going way too inside baseball. Anyway, he had a bookshelf in the back of his car and was like, I don't want this. Do you want this? And I was like, no, let's just put it on the street for somebody. And so he opened up his trunk, the two of us who are both, like, you're what, 5'8"?
Yeah, 5'8", 5'9".
And I'm, like, 5'5". So he dwarfs me, neither big men.
Yeah, it was a very heavy bookshelf.
Very heavy bookshelf, so we grabbed it, just sort of, like, hustled it out, put it right by a church, and then, like,
and gunned it.
Zipped away.
Yeah, last time I saw you, I was like, see you later.
He's like, see ya, bye.
Yeah.
And now we're here, because I'm going to arrest you.
Oh, shit.
Under arrest, Nick.
That'd be awesome.
Veronica's actually a cop.
Yeah. That'd be crazy, considering how long we've known each other. I didn't know you were a cop.
She's been going through cop school. That's what that's called?
Yeah.
She's been going through cop school for this.
I once went to, this is just a weird thing, but I once went to a hockey game where the Red Wings were playing the Kings, and there was a guy, I was wearing Detroit gear, I'm from Michigan, and a lot of people at sporting events like to talk shit about the economy of Detroit instead of the sports teams, which is rather annoying. And this one guy kept looking at me and my friends, and he was like, what's it like to buy a house for $2? And all this, like, really stupid shit.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, fuck this guy. And then a fight broke out, like, a row over from us. Like, some dude just, like, landed a haymaker into this guy's face.
The same guy?
No, these two other guys. And the guy who was talking shit was a cop. And he, like, ripped out a badge. And I was like, you were a cop? And that's when I started becoming part of the resistance.
That's what did it.
I was like, God.
At the end of this, you're going to have a fist fight with that cop.
I'm going to have to find him.
And whoever wins is going to, like, the world will be the way they want it to be.
Oh, boy.
So you better start training now, buddy.
I'll have to, yeah. Oh, God.
I'm going to Rocky you.
That would be a nightmare.
This has been dope. I want you to plug hard so that people can find you.
Oh, yes. If you want to find me on Twitter, just Nick Scardarasi. It's Skardarasy.
Slow that down because his name is very complicated.
Skardarasy. And if you want to listen to our podcast, that's cool to plug.
No, please plug your podcast.
It's called We Rebel. It's on Apple Podcasts. Ryan Middledorf and Ryan Kunzhaus. I always mispronounce his last name. I feel terrible if he's hearing this. But they're wonderful. Did I get it right? Kunzhaus? Oh, thank you. They're both amazing, and they produce our podcast, and it's with Emily Wanzerski and James Tolbert. They're my two co-hosts. One of the best interviews we ever did was right before Christmas break. We interviewed Michael Blake, who's one of the vice chairs of the DNC. It's incredibly inspiring. So get involved. Get uncomfy.
Fuck yeah.
It's kind of fun.
Guys, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. As always, I love it when people listen. Please, if this inspired you in any way, go out and do something. And also, let me know about it. You can find me on Facebook at Least Pod, and I'm also on Instagram at Least Pod as well. And other than that, if you like this episode or any other, please share it with a friend, like it on iTunes, review it. That actually goes a long way for other people to find it.
Definitely review.
A review. It's all word of mouth. I remember once you were getting some bad press, right?
Yeah, we get some Trumpies every now and then.
He got some Trump train, so people were reviewing his to get the Trump train away.
Yeah.
Reviewing matters, guys. Thank you so much. If you are listening to this while walking your dog, just keep him on a tight leash.
Oh,
make sure
hip
to curb
check
them.
Hip check your dog. Sorry. I don't have a dog, but like I've had friends who their dogs have been killed, and like cuz they run around a corner or people come out of their apartments and their driveways, they don't see the bushes, and you have a dog 10 feet in front of you, and then your dog gets run over for what? For being interested in the world.
Yeah.
So hip check your fucking dog.
Guys, hip check your dog. That's what this podcast has been about.
So heated about that. I can't believe I got so mad at the end about that.
Maybe that's what we should have interviewed you about.
So mad. I don't even have a dog, but every time I see people with a fucking leash forever, I'm just like, hip check. Get your dog here. Makes me so mad.
Well, guys, it's been great. I will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
For class and show information, visit nerdistschool.com.